Accession number 9146, rule number 7.
Well,
Brigadier Wedderburn Maxwell, tape 7. Yes, would you mind continuing with the story of Third Epes?
I've got to come to it now. We were all told about this tremendous French offensive. I forget what subsidiary tax we put in. It might have been the Vimy time, I'm not certain. But Nivelle attacked, and they say he lost 100,000 men in the first hour. Finish. And more than finish. If you read history, you will find that the French government told Winston Churchill that their armies were no longer fit for in any position to attack. In fact, some of them couldn't even be relied upon in defense. So we were absolutely alone, once more. Absolutely. Russia had collapsed, was out of it altogether. The troops were beginning to come across from Russia to France, and we were in a really desperate strait. And there was the British army, which was by that time was a pretty good size and very good stuff. It could only be used to attack, because we knew, and the French knew, that if the Germans really did a big, a major attack against the French and knocked them out, we couldn't have held the line alone. I mean, the French held it over half the line from Switzerland to the sea, and we could not have taken their place at all, by any means. And then what would have happened? I suppose a sort of a temporary Dunkirk. But however, it meant that we'd got to attack and attack and attack to keep the Germans, prevent them going down to Verdun or the French weak spots and finishing off. And that's why I think we had to do the Third Epes. It was pretty horrible.
Did you realise that situation at the time?
Or I think we did, yes. We were told there'd be no more. Yes, we gradually. No, we saw why we'd got to attack. I don't think we knew the full dangerous position. But my division was. A division's 20,000 men, you know, four brigades and all that. And we moved up close behind Ypres. And the general had an artillery or a divisional horse show, for show jumping and turnout of charges and everything. And I had two very good horses, and I won a couple of prizes at it in the afternoon. And that evening we had a bit of a blind at the general's headquarters. He was a nasty little Jew boy, but he was quite a capable little man called Lamont. And during dinner, where there was a dozen of us, Lamy was called to the telephone. He came back and he turned to me and said, Farrar has been killed today commanding a battery in the 1st Division. You ought to go up and replace him tomorrow. Well, I swallowed twice, and it was plenty to swallow. And I went home, went to bed with very mixed feelings, because we hadn't been to Ypres for some time, but we knew its reputation, and I was all ready to go up into this and take over a strange battery in a strange part of the line, a strange war. But that morning after, that was cancelled, and the senior captain, I was a captain by then, the senior captain in the division had to go up and take charge. Now the senior captain was a magnificent man, year above me in the batting order, called Stanford, one of the bravest of the very brave, and with two magnificent sons now. His sailor son has been in charge of the fleet lately, Stanford, and his other son is a major general, somewhere knocking about. Anyhow, that was called off, as far as I was concerned, and then we were told to be ready for this third battle of Ypres. We moved up, and we were told where to go to decide on our battery gun position, actual gun positions. And I went up. I didn't know where my major was, but there's a major always commanding a battery. But I was acting for him. I think he was on leave. And I went up to a place. There's a big lake just outside Ypres called Zillebeek. And I went along to the German side of Zillebeek, and the great big bund, or building, you know, a dam. And I marked out where my guns are going to go, And again, I had water behind me, which made it nice and safe for the overs. And took up the next night, I took up 1,000 rounds of ammunition and six great camouflage nets. That's ordinary netting with little tags on to break the photograph from the air so it didn't show up the guns. It's all part of the concealment. Well, every night we had to take up this ammunition, 1,000 rounds, for about a week, which is a hell of a lot of ammunition. And then we settled in there and registered ourselves in and were waiting ready for the big fire plan. In the meantime, the Germans, they were all around us, because that was called the salient, and they were three quarters of the way around, literally, I think. And we had a very rough time, and where I was, at the edge of a little saucer of land, say a quarter of a mile wide, six regiments of artillery, all British artillery, all crowded in there to thicken up this enormous concentration of guns. And the German fire got worse and worse. To get to it, we had to go up a corduroy road of logs, tree trunks. Everything else was all mud. And the horses staggered along over this and drew up the wagons, or took them up eight rounds on each horse round the saddle, round the neck. And this time, then we were just waiting for the go-off and the battle to start. In the meantime, the Germans thought they'd really got hold of us this time, and they started shelling us very heavily. And one particular day, just when it got really bad, it started in the morning and it went on all day. These rump, rump, all round you. And the battery in front of me had all six guns destroyed by shell fire, about 200 yards away, direct hits of shells on it. And so by the end of the day, I rang up my colonel and I said, can't you do something about this? We've had this going all day. I've been timing it lately. There's a round comes very close into our area and in among all the guns every 2 seconds. And if you work that out, that's 30 rounds a minute, and if you work that out for an hour, that's 1,800 rounds in an hour. All in this tiny space, the stuff is pouring in, and we've really just about had all we want. And he said, well, I'll see if I can do anything. The dear old Wheeler, he was a very old man and full of whiskey. He lived in the ramparts at Ypres, which were great bank things about the height of this house, and absolutely safe against anything. But he went round his guns every day, every morning early, about 4 or 5 in the morning. He's a magnificent old soldier. And I got hold of him, and he said, I see what can be done. And within about an hour and a half, he came through, and he said, they're going to turn on all the heavies. And then it did start. He said, there's a concentration coming on at some, whatever the time was, which is 3:30. And so this German bombardment of our area went on and on, and then all of a sudden there was a terrific rush, a kind of an uproar rush from behind us as our heavies opened.
What a relief that must have been for you.
It was quite extraordinary. And the troops were laughing and cheering, and there wasn't not a round came back. You see, before a battle, you had to locate the enemy guns by their sound ranging, among other things. And so we knew where everything was. And so the battle plan for the big offensive opening was already there, and everybody knew where the enemy guns were. And nothing came back at all. It was the most amazing feeling, suddenly, after this absolute hell, to have this. So then the battle went ahead, we fired our bombardment, the Germans were driven back 2,000 or 3,000 yards along the road between Ypres and Menin, eastward we went. And my major was still away, and I had to move my battery forward along the main road and down to a place called Hooge, H-O-O-G-E, where we went into action in the old German front line. And there were just a lot of little trenches, all been hammered to bits by our heavies. And that night, as I say in my book, was the worst night of my whole life. The Germans turned on their gas. You asked about gas. The air was absolutely full of shell coming all down into our area. The mustard gas was deadly stuff. If it was very cold frost, it didn't evaporate. The result was that when the frost went, suddenly large areas came up in poison gas. The phosgene, all the other stuff, the other gas, and the tear gas too, which meant you had to wear your gas helmet. You know the things. What the troops called goggle-eyed booger with tit. This, you stick out in front. And my brother went to sleep a whole one night in one, in his position. Anyhow, this was just about... I broke down. Nobody saw. I was all alone in one little bit of ditch. The troops were the same, all lying about in their ditches. We had nothing to shoot. We weren't in action. If we'd been in action, we'd been quite different. We'd have been hitting back. But there were no targets for us. We'd only just got into action. And it was awful. Next morning, we woke up and the shelling had stopped. The day was brighter. There wasn't a man hurt in the battery. And I felt I'd recovered myself.
Was that your worst night of the war?
Mm-hmm. It really was. I saw plenty of bad nights, but that really was. At least to me it was. Because I say that I just simply felt I was finished. I couldn't bear, there was nothing to do, nowhere to go to, just lay there and waited to be blown to bits by something. It was very, very unpleasant. However, one got over it, and the men were all right. And then, very shortly after that, my major came back. And I had to revert to my normal captain's job of getting up ammunition and rations through Ypres, which didn't matter much, we weren't shelling it then, but up into the battle area, along the main road. And there, I had to get this ammunition up to the guns along this main road. And there was one big bend in the main road called Hellfire Corner. It wasn't a strict corner, but it was a bend in the road. And the Germans from over by a place called Pilkem, they could see our road, they could see the traffic, and so they could shell it. And we had put up screens of canvas so as to hide our movement up to a point. But I was faced again with a problem which, as a gunner, I was able to compete with. Because we had 20 or 30 horses each with 8 rounds slung around him, and the driver leading 2 horses, walking up this road, and the shells coming over on the road. One over the road, another well over, one a bit short, another one very short. And so one waited till one had hit the road and thought, now I'm safe, whipped up the next little party, sent them to trot up the road, and by the time the turn came for the next road to drop on the road, that little batch was safe, and so the next batch was ready to go. And I timed it knowing the fact that guns don't all shoot alike, some overshoot, some undershoot, there are errors and so on. And knowing that, I was able to time when I pushed my little party of half a dozen drivers with 200 or 300 rounds of ammunition through to walk quietly on up the road to the battery position. And with that way we got away with it. But I always used to send them, as soon as a man, a wagon, or a man with 2 horses had unloaded the guns, I roared him back as hard as he could get because of this awful shelling all day and all night. And then, soon after that, we were pulled back, I forget what for, but I was appointed acting major. Now, you got an acting rank, which did carry the pay, I think, but it was only acting rank. After that, if you were there long enough, you became temporary. So I did become a temporary major. And then I went on to command the battery as a temporary major. I went to command the 1st Battery RFA, which I'd been seen at Leeds at the beginning of the war. I took command of them. And we were down in front of a place called Plug Street Wood, which was very close to the line, and my guns were just along the front edge of it. And for an OP, instead of having to go up a tree or go into a farmhouse or go into a trench, I had a naval periscope. And I went and sat on a stool like this, with the periscope like this, and it stuck up right above the, among the treetops, and you could watch the front through your periscope all the while. My colonel came up and said, where are your guns? I said, they're here, sir. He said, really, you're not dug in, you're not protected. I said, no, sir, I'd sooner be hidden and not disclose my position to the air. I'd sooner not make gun pits and all the material of iron and corrugated iron and everything else. He said, well, you do as you're told, you dig your guns in. I said, well, sir, I'll tell you another thing. As long as they don't see me, don't know I'm here, my battery is safe and my battery is ready to fire. And what's more, as we have 50 rounds a night to shoot off what they call harassing fire into the German lines up and down their trenches or roads, as I have to do that, what I do every evening, I take two of my guns, manhandle them with a dozen men down the road with their ammunition for a quarter of a mile, do the night firing from there. Didn't matter damn how much they were shelled in the morning, there's nobody there, but they'd come back again. And it was just a bit of an old soldier, a young man, which I put into practice. However, the colonel wasn't pleased with this. He said, your horses are looking awful. You've got to go down to the transport lines, the horse lines, somewhere behind Ypres it was, and get something done about it. And I went down, and in this chair, there was a dear little family of epicerie, is Samine place. And the eldest girl was about 20. She was very nice, and second girl was a year younger. She was a very lovable little creature with a naughty pair of lips. Not that I ever managed to kiss her, I don't think. But we used to go there to 13 Rue de Lille, Esther, in the evenings. Any of the officers down at the horse lines used to spend their time over there in the evenings and drinking cheap champagne and flirting, but so mildly. I mean, no case of kissing these girls. And Madame kept a pretty sharp eye on us. And I went down to look after the horses, and then I got the notice, you will now go, revert to actually to captaincy, and hand over to somebody or other.
Was that because you disagreed with your superior?
Yes, because I was
How did you feel about that? Because obviously you had worked out your own position so carefully.
Yes.
Did it dishearten you, that attitude? Mm? Did his attitude dishearten you a lot?
It made me very angry. I thought it was damned unfair, because a shell came over right into the guns and killed about four men very shortly after this. I felt that it was not anything to do with me. But of course, one had been in the war a long time by then, 3 years, and they published an order that officers who had been in action for any length of time like that, 3 years, could apply to go home leave to England. Not home leave, home service. And I'd come back to England and somebody goes and take my place. But I just, as I say in my book, I couldn't contemplate it.
Why was that?
It wouldn't have been fair. And I was too fond of my men and too fond of my horses. But it was undoubted it was because I was so at home there. And also reading Lord Chandos's life, and I met him since, he's dead now, but I met him and we got very close friends. He was Oliver Littleton when he was in the Grenadiers. And Oliver was home very badly wounded, but he said that when he got on his legs again and was moving about as a convalescent in London, he could not bear the atmosphere. And the sooner he got back, the better.
Did he tell you what the atmosphere was?
Yes. He said it was just they weren't taking it seriously in the war, and people were all looking after themselves and so on, so forth. And it came in my next chapter. I'll tell you about what was happening at home. Of course, I wasn't there, but we saw from the business end what was happening. Anyhow, it was one of the minor decisions, and I very rarely had to make it to volunteer for anything. I did volunteer once about this time to go as an air observer with the Royal Flying Corps, but probably just as well. They wouldn't allow any regular service officers to go. All the regulars were busy on the ground, and they said anybody can go up in an aeroplane and say, what's happening? And so I wasn't allowed to go there. Probably just as well. I don't suppose I'd be talking to you now. Then, so back I went, and I didn't like my new major. and didn't get on at all happily with him. And then this third Battle of Ypres, it started a fortnight, possibly a week or more, before Ypres started, that much after one of our real big successes. Just south of Ypres there's a long ridge called Wichita or Messine, and that was in German hands, and had been attacked and failed. Lord Plumer, General Plumer, who was the oldest of the generals and looked a funny old man, but was a brilliant general, and General Harrington, who was his chief of staff, they undermined probably half a mile or possibly even a mile at intervals. They undermined with colossal mines at colossal depth, and they touched off these mines just before the infantry assault, and the mines were heard in London.
Did you hear these? You heard
them? Oh, yeah, I heard them. We all heard them. Yes, we were all listening madly for the machine's mine. And the Germans, the whole bank of six went up in the air, all their line of defence and everything else. There was nothing there except dead Germans and bits of dead Germans. And our troops went forward with very, very small, if any, casualties. It was a masterpiece of hard work over the years, getting all these mining done, but it was a complete success as an opener to the Battle of Ypres. To the third Battle of Ypres. Well, the mud was terrible, and again we couldn't take guns, wheel traffic up against the mud. The trouble about that mud was that we did as much to make it to create it as the Germans did or as anybody else did. The mere shell fire digging holes as deep as this room, you can see what happened to that lawn with a couple of dozen shells there. You could do nothing about it. Your horses got covered with mud right up into their fetlocks, and their right up to the elbow. And our main job with the horses was, especially in the frosty weather when it all froze hard, was to get this off without damaging the horse and tearing the skin.
What did the landscape look like?
It was just a deadly, dull, dark brown muck. There were a few tree stumps sticking up. That was about all there was. There were no leaves or anything. Of course, there was no such thing as cultivation. And there were just the remains of the odd church, or the odd church. The Germans made some pillboxes by then, great concrete things, which enabled them to hang on to bits of the line, otherwise they'd have been driven out. I was not doing forward observer at all. I was doing my battery captain's job, which was commanding the guns when the major wasn't there, and doing the servicing from behind when he was there. That was a captain's job.
Were there many dead about, dead bodies?
One didn't see a great many, but of course there were. I think one probably, not exactly turned a blind eye, but it wasn't the sort of thing one liked brooding over.
And how about the horses? Did you lose many horses?
Yes, we lost quite a few. And I remember when, in the first earlier days at Zillibeek Lake, going up with my teams and the camouflage nets to the guns, and then going home as hard as I could afterwards, my sergeant major and I saw the whole job done, and then we turned for home just as the shelling of this Corduroy Road started up. And I gave a yell to sergeant major. Sergeant major, don't you wait for me, I'm not waiting for you. And I put my legs onto my horse, and he did the same. We got away with it. I had a very nice little mare. I think I counted something over 30 little flecks where little bits of metal from an exploding shell had got her. And I remember galloping past a water cart with a horse alive in it, just off the track, but I couldn't stop and do anything about that. One's responsibility was entirely for the guns, to get them serviceable and keep them right. Now, I can't paint a picture of lots of dead, because I didn't see them there, but in the trenches, of course, where there'd been slight advances, they were sometimes built up with dead bodies.
And if there are 20 people that have been killed in one particular machine gun burst, and you were behind it all, you just piled the bodies on top of each other as sandbags. Frightfully impersonal.
This third battle of Ypres, you know, you have explained the reasons for it very well. But at the time, could you see the sense of it?
Yes. Well, I think yes, one could, because having been told there was no more offensive action possible by the French army, by then we knew there was a very bad outlook when it came to defence even, that you couldn't trust the French. And this is acknowledged by the French government to our government. So there was no question of rumours or anything like that about it. It really was terribly bad.
What was your morale like at this time?
I was good. I don't know why. I do know. There's a tremendous feeling of camaraderie among gunners. My general in this last war said, you know, your guns, they always stick together. I said, well, sir, you've got your infantry, they may be working in pairs and so on, but our guns are our colours, and there are six men manning a gun, and the people behind it, and you just can't let each other down. You have to stick together, and you do. We went back into rest or recuperation, and my brother Cub, by then he must have been 20 or something nearly as old as that, Cub and I rode into Estaire that first night to our little épicerie, and there was Mickey, and he just broke down. He loved that brother of mine. He was an awfully nice little boy. He was a very good soldier and absolutely ruthless in his ideas of discipline. And luckily, as I say, he was under a great personal friend of mine. And I know that the general sent up the brigade major to ask young Wedderburn Maxwell to come and be my ADC. And Cub said, I wouldn't dream of it. I'm happy here, I hate the staff and anything to do with the staff, which is pretty very good for a boy of 19 to a very senior staff officer.
But Mickey was surprised to see you both come out, was he?
Mickey what?
He was surprised to see you, the two.
Yes, he was. He was just so overjoyed to find us both alive still. So.